Tonight we're going to take a look at the material covered in Chapter 13. We're going to look at property rights and related to property rights, we're going to look at the issues around liability and the role of the courts. Okay, so now property rights and property rights economics is a whole brand of discipline that you can study extensively. There are courses and whole disciplines devoted to it. Okay, and when you look at what we learn in school, in the undergraduate level, we teach what is primarily known as neoclassical economics. And neoclassical economics has the utility function on one side and the production function on the other side. And we view that the utility function gives us demand, and from the production function we get the supply curve, and together this story leads to the notion of the market. And okay, and up here in the notion of the production function is where we give the idea of the firm. So we think of the firm as this so-called production function, and the firm is this entity that takes inputs into the so-called production function, and it gives us output. Okay. And seconding our concept of the firm, we look at how we equate the marginal product of labor to the real wage, which is the wage rate divided by the price of the good. And we measure the demand for labor based on some kind of technological metric. Okay. So if we look at input like labor, and then the marginal product and the average product, we tend to get a picture that looks something like this. And the marginal product comes up through the minimum. So the marginal product and the average product. And we say that in this story, that when we start producing goods and services, the firm starts producing. Initially, there is some kind of increasing return to the variable input. As we add more workers, the combination of workers in this production technology causes the output on the margin to rise faster than the previous unit. And then at some point, we experience the so-called law of diminishing returns. And then when we hit the point where we hit the marginal product to zero, we have maximized short run total output. And the shape of these curves are what drives most of our economic stories in the short run. They're based on technology. So the nature of the production technology is what gives us the so-called dome-shaped marginal product and average product. And then in your principles class, it's a short step to take the from the input-output story to go to output and cost of output, which gives us our average cost of production and our marginal cost of production. So because of the technology of the production function that gives us the law of diminishing returns, we get a picture of the firm that gives us this shape. So we can say that our firm initially, as it produces, the average cost of production falls, and then it hits some efficient point where it's at the lowest average cost, and then if it produces beyond that point, the per unit costs again begin to rise. And this has nothing to do with anything but the technology of the particular factory, the business. And in this story, workers, labor, are just measured as homogeneous efficiency units. So we don't talk about hard workers versus lazy workers. We don't talk about having someone who's smarter than another person or stronger than another person in the work process. Every worker is identical, and the changes in productivity is strictly driven by the technology they're working with. Well, there's another view of economics, which is the property rights paradigm, which looks at the shape of the average cost curves that is based on something other than technology. And so when we look at a firm producing output, then we have the U-shaped average cost, okay? We credit the downward sloping portion of the average cost is due to teamwork. People working together are more productive than people working individually. Then, when average costs start to rise, they refer to that as being a problem of the free rider. We're going to discuss what that means shortly. Okay. Now, the property rights paradigm goes back to people such as Ronald Coase, Yoram Barzel, and Stephen Chung. And you will see some of their works are on the reading list for this class. So they looked at this problem of how we interacted in production based not on the technology, but based on the rules by which people came together. And they looked at the governance structure by which people came together. So the example to illustrate what I'm talking about is, consider where we have two people own one truck. And they are partners. Okay. And they share the costs equally. Fifty-fifty. Okay. And the first person he drives in the day. And person two, drives at night. So they operate the truck 24 hours and they do deliveries, pickups, different types of anything that they can get paid to use the truck to carry out some activity for pay. So they're doing deliveries and pickups. Okay. So each person gets paid based on the business he generates on his shift. And for the maintenance of the truck, they split the costs 50-50. So let's suppose that person one can increase his revenue by an additional $60 if he drives the truck harder. So by driving the truck harder, he's wearing out the truck. He is making it so we have to do maintenance sooner. And it increases the costs of maintaining the truck by $100. Okay. So we look at this and we say, well, if you drive the truck harder, you make an extra $60 in revenue. But you add another $100 in costs. So clearly this isn't something we should do. However, since costs are shared, the driver during the day sees the following. He sees $60 in revenue and $50 in cost because he only pays half of the cost. So in his mind, there's a net gain of $10. So he passes $50 of the cost on. So he is in essence free riding and abusing the truck that he's partnered with in order to make extra revenue. So this is an example of what the property rights people see as the free rider problem. And it comes from the fact that the way the contract or the relationship is set up between these people allows this to happen. Okay. So now, property rights okay, involve, when we talk about having property rights or ownership, okay, we tend to take that for granted. It means I own my house, I own my car, that's my property. But there is a lot more elements to property rights than people often first consider. So for something to be private property, you need three things. You have to have the right to exclude. So if I own a piece of land, I have the right to say that other people cannot go on that land. If I'm selling something, like I'm selling apples, I have the right to deny you an apple if you won't pay my price. That's what it means by the right to exclude. Two, I have to have the right, oops, one second. I have to have the right to transfer. That means to sell my property. And three, I need the right to derive income. Okay. If I have all three of these rights, then I have what is known as true private property. So when we talk about capitalism as a type of social structure, that's what capitalism, people think of capitalism as being about markets. Capitalism is not about markets because socialism, communism, feudalism, any types of the isms have markets in them. Capitalism is about property rights. Okay. Most importantly, private property. So, this is true private property. Okay. Now, the property rights approach says that I can look at economic and social problems around these three rules and see that most economic social problems can be identified as being the problem of either one of these three rights being missing or very difficult to enforce. So consider borrowing money. Okay. So a human versus a firm. Okay. So you, as the human being, cannot borrow against your future income. So here you are, you're young, you're healthy, you've gone through SFU, you've got your degree, you've got a really good job, you have a good future, you go to the bank and you say, I'm going to earn $1 million over the next 10 years. I'd like to get half of it today. And I would like to borrow it from the bank. The bank will not make that loan. They will say, we'll lend you money if you own a house or you have other some other type of collateral, but they will not lend you money against your future income. A firm, on the other hand, can borrow against its future income. It happens all the time. Okay. So why is it that firms can borrow against their earnings and humans cannot? Well, humans are missing number two off on my list. So, you as a human being have the right to exclude. That means people, I have the right to say no one can touch me. My body is my private property and no one can do anything to me. That's what it means to exclude. Do I have the right to derive income? Yes, I can take with my brain and my body, I can work and I can earn income. What I cannot do is use myself as collateral. We have outlawed slavery. So I cannot offer to sell myself into slavery in return for borrowing against my future earnings, saying, if I don't pay you back, you can make me work it off. This is called indentured servitude, and it is, in fact, something that used to exist. And people are very aware of the history of slavery in the United States, dealing with mainly the Africans. But what many people don't realize is from other parts of the world, there were people who entered into voluntary contracts where they would say, I come from Eastern Europe, I come from Asia, I will agree to be your slave for 5 years if you bring me to America. And so this is where someone enters into a voluntary slave contract. These have been outlawed for more than 100 years. So that missing property right means that you cannot access capital markets and borrow against your future income. Okay. Now, we often find these types of, let's check and see how our, yeah, someone in the waiting room. Okay. So we can find that this kind of behavior exists throughout history, even in pre-industrialized economies. So if we look at North America, and we had, this is pre-European, so back before the Europeans came to North America and changed things for the indigenous people, they had a very sophisticated society, much more than people realize. And if we look at the sort of eastern part, we had in the area that is now what we know is Ontario, Quebec, and New York State. Okay, this was a region that was known as Mohawk Territory. Okay. And then there were other groups that had their territories. The Huron territory. Okay. Now, within the territories, there's lots of evidence of that the Mohawks practiced sustainable resource management. Okay, so within the territory that belonged to each of these indigenous groups, they had rules around how much you could hunt, how much you could fish, and how you used the resources within their territory, and they were very protective of it. The food supply in these areas were mainly things like deer. Now, deer, or a type of animal that tends to not migrate very far. So if deer are living within a certain area, they tend to stay there. And so the indigenous people of the area recognized that if they killed too many deer, there wouldn't be enough for future. So they very carefully managed their stocks of food because they recognized that this was their property right. If we look on the prairies, okay, prairies, the food supply was buffalo or bison. And the indigenous groups that lived in this area, if you were to talk to them and say, where is your territory? The indigenous peoples would say typically, we don't have a territory. We don't own the land. We belong to the land. So what happened is that the indigenous groups living in the prairies, there would be a giant herd of buffalo, which they would hunt, and that would be their food supply. They would set up a settlement near the buffalo herd. But then the buffalo herd would move. And they lacked the ability to contain the buffalo. There was no trees, no fencing. So basically, if the buffalo herd decided to wander off to a new region, there was really nothing the indigenous people could do to stop them. So their ability to enforce their property right over the buffalo was too costly. So that was an example of where their system was set up that said, this is a common property. We don't have a private property because the cost of enforcing the private property is too high. These large animals that moved in massive herds pretty much went where they wanted. And if you wanted to have buffalo as your food source, you pretty much had to follow them wherever they went back then. Okay. Now, So we will change our rules as the costs of enforcing property rights change. Okay. So consider one of the better examples is the California Gold Rush. In the 1840s. Okay. So when gold was discovered in the California area, somebody would set up a gold mine. And word got out all over North America that there was gold in California. And people came to California in massive, massive numbers looking to get their share of the gold. And the stories that went back to New York and Boston and Philadelphia were that basically you just walked across the countryside picking up giant gold nuggets. Well, gold mining is a very difficult line of work. So it is typically done by hydraulics where gold comes like granules of pepper. And what happens if they find gold in a mountainside, you basically have to dig it out, rinse away all the other dirt, and capture the gold particles in a fine screen. So what happened is that the people that found the best spots for gold mining were doing very well. And as other people came and looked to try to set up a gold mine, they were not so successful. So then you had the problem of people becoming what are known as claim jumpers. And these are people that steal place spots for gold mining by force. So somebody shows up from California, wanders around the mountains trying to find some gold that they can dig out of the ground. They have no luck. They see that Joe has a gold mine. He's doing quite well. They just walk over there and shoot him. This forces, so gold mines companies started hiring security. These are the gunslingers of the old West. So anyone who had a gold mine would have to hire somebody to stand guard to protect him from a claims jumper. And pretty soon, each company had a small army. And these small armies all profit from gold mining was spent on their armies. So the gold mining companies that were all over California, and at that time, California was a territory. And the beauty of being a territory is there was no real government. So, under a territory, they didn't have to pay taxes, they didn't have any government services provided. They were free to go and just mine their gold and earn their profit. But now they find that they are not making a profit because they're spending all of their earnings protecting their property right. So they realize that the cost of enforcing property rights was too high. Okay, so what did they do? They decided to become a state. So the state of California came into existence. They then have government. That means they pay taxes. But the government supplies the security. So instead of each gold mine having its own private army of people to guard them, the government now supplies police forces, armed forces that protect everybody. In return, now they have to pay taxes and other costs associated with living in a society that has an organized government. So the trade-off was that they realized that the cost of enforcing property rights under the rules that governed a territory, which originally they was very appealing because it meant that you had no taxes, you could go into a territory, be a farmer, be a miner, be a logger, whatever you did, you earn the profit of your exercise and your activity without any cost other than the simple cost of production. However, as the environment changed and they realized that the cost of protecting and enforcing the value they were creating got too high, they came together and changed the system. So it became a state. Okay. Now, that brings us to Ronald Coase. Now, Ronald Coase won the Nobel Prize in economics. For the works he did, and he's famous for two papers. In 1932, he wrote a paper called Theory of the Firm. And in 1960, he wrote a paper called The Problem of Social Cost. Okay. So, if you can write two really good papers in your lifetime, even if it's 30 years apart, you may get a Nobel Prize. Okay. So, in Ronald Coase's first paper, which first started people thinking about things in a different way, he looked at this nature of how we organize ourselves. So, if you consider that we go from a tree gets cut down into a log. So, a logger comes along, cuts a tree down, cuts it into pieces. The log goes to a sawmill where it's turned into lumber. The lumber then goes to a shop where somebody makes furniture. And from the furniture, it goes to ultimately to the consumer. Okay, so this is the production process. So Coase looks at this and says, what makes up a firm? Well, each of these activities, so the guy that cuts down the tree into a log, he can sell the log to the sawmill. And so there's a transaction between the guy that cuts down the log, cuts it down the tree into logs, and he sells it to the person who turns it into lumber. The guy that turns it into lumber, he sells it to the guy that makes furniture. And the guy that makes furniture sells it to the consumer. So we have four transactions along this story. That would give us three firms and the consumer. But we could also see it where one person owns the sawmill and the furniture shop and hires the loggers and pays everybody who does each of these steps, and that makes this whole process a single firm. So you can look at a production process and say it could be many firms working in sequence, or it could be a single firm. And what determined whether it was multiple firms or single firms was the nature of the relationship. So if everyone along each step of this process agrees to follow my instructions in return for a salary, then I have created a single firm. But if each person in the production process negotiates a price with the next step of the production process, then we would have multiple firms. But the activity would be identical. And that's when people started realizing that this concept of the firm and this co is not so much the production function, but the nature of the contracts and the rules that we set out that governs how this transaction is carried out, which will determine whether we have multiple small firms in the process or one large firm. So, Coase then, in 1960, looked at another issue of what he called the social cost. And he got this from looking at the development of the railway across the USA. So in the 1800s, the United States built a massive railway infrastructure all over the United States. And the purpose of the railway was to open up access to markets so that farmers in the Midwest could get their crops to New York. Okay. So everyone recognizes the benefit of the railway, and if we don't have the railway system built, then we don't have any way of moving the timber, the minerals, or the crops from the Midwest of the United States to the eastern seaboard, where the population mainly lived and where production and technology type production carried out. So the railway benefited this process, but the railway created a problem. And the problem was that you could have a say a plot of farmland. Okay. And the government said, well, we have to have a railway, so we're going to give the railway a right of way through the farmer's land. So the railway came through, and the farmer had to let the railway go through the middle of his farmland. Okay. So there were negotiations, some compensation was paid, many cases it wasn't paid. But after the railway was built, a new problem arose, whereas the train came down the tracks, depending what the farmer was doing, he had a problem of the train had sparks that came off the wheels that set fires to the crops. Okay. So as the train travels through the farmland, sparks, because you have in those days metal wheels on metal rails and trains traveling at high speed, were frequently causing sparks that jumped off the train, got into the crops, the corn, the wheat, started fires, and then they would lose the crop. So the farmers were arguing that the train was hurting their business and that the trains should slow down. The railway said that if we slow down, we won't be able to get all the crops and all the timber and all the minerals from the Midwest to New York. So this led to an ongoing dispute and people arguing about who was right and who was wrong. Who was the good guy and who was the bad guy? So this caused Coase to look at this whole problem and posit the following. So Coase said, suppose we have A does an activity that hurts B. So A could be our railway. A could be a neighbor that burns garbage in his backyard and the smoke comes into your yard. It could be anything. So people would go to court. So B goes to court. And seeks protection. Okay. So in this story, the problem is set up that A has done something to hurt B. So Coase points out that protecting A, or sorry, protecting B will hurt A. So assuming that person A is doing some activity that is beneficial to A, then if the court tells A they must stop, then that will hurt A. So Coase looked at this and said, this is a problem of incompatible use. And the problem is that it's due to lack of defined property rights. Okay. And Coase further said, that the courts should assign the property right to A or B and that it doesn't matter which one. Okay, they will sort it out once the property rights assigned. Until the property rights assigned, they will not be able to sort it out. So let's walk through an illustration of how that works. So let's suppose we have a chemical factory we'll call C and a laundry service we'll call L. Okay. And emissions from C damage L. Okay. The damage is $100. So the chemical factory's emissions increase the costs of cleaning to the laundromat by $100. And that is the only damage, and those are the only two parties involved in this. So the chemical factory carries out their business, the laundry service carries out their business, but because of the chemical factory, they incur an additional $100 cost because of the emissions coming from the factory, forcing them to further clean the laundry that they're doing that they wouldn't have to spend if the chemical factory wasn't there. So, one solution a scrubber and a scrubber is a type of filter. Okay. And so C can install a scrubber and then there's no damage to the laundry service. Okay. Cost of the scrubber, though, is $1,000. Okay. So, the chemical factory is polluting. It's damaging L, and C and L wind up going to court. And the court has a choice. They can give the right to C, or they can give the right to L. Okay. So, if they give the right to C, then that means C is allowed to pollute. If they give the right to the laundromat L, then L is entitled to the right to clean air. So then, either C puts in a scrubber, or C pays L. So if the laundromat gets the right to pollute, or gets the right to clean air, and that means that the court has told the chemical factory that they have to do something about the pollution, they have to either spend $1,000 or they go to the laundromat and they offer a price greater than $100 and compensate the laundromat and are allowed to pollute. So any price that's greater than $100 will make the laundromat better off than before. So even without the chemical factory, they don't have the $100 cost. With the chemical factory, they get the $100 cost, but if they receive $200 from the chemical factory, they're $100 better off than before. Any price that is less than $1,000 and greater than $100 would make the chemical factory better off, because unless they can negotiate a price, they have to spend $1,000 on a scrubber. And if these two can negotiate and come to a price, there's a price that makes both parties better off. And the outcome will be that the chemical factory will not buy a scrubber, but instead they will pollute. Now, if the court gives the right to the chemical factory, then L incurs a cost of $100, or L bribes the laundromat or the chemical factory not to pollute. Well, the chemical factory would require a bribe that is greater than or equal to $1,000. So the laundromat can get the chemical factory to stop polluting if they pay $1,000, or they can let the chemical factory pollute and incur a cost of $100. So if the court gives the right to the chemical factory, the outcome will be that the chemical factory pollutes. If they give the right to the laundromat, the chemical factory will pay the laundromat $100 or greater and still pollute. So at the end of the day, no matter which way the courts find, the chemical factory will be polluting, since they value the resource more than the laundromat. They will always wind up in a position where they're polluting. And it makes no sense to pay $1,000 to solve a problem that costs $100. So you don't spend $1,000 to solve a $100 problem. Now, the only thing that's different here is that in one case, if the courts find in favor of the chemical factory, then the laundromat loses $100. If the court finds in favor of the laundromat, then the laundry will get $100. So the only thing that happens, the only issue is one of distribution. And from an economic perspective, both outcomes are equally efficient. So while the chemical factory is better off under the situation where they get the right and the laundromat's worse off in terms of their profit, whereas the other way, the laundromat receives a compensation, then we can argue that we have a winner and a loser, and as an economist, we say from an efficiency perspective, it's a zero-sum game. Okay. Now, for this to work, the chemical factory they must be able to negotiate. Okay. So, the way Coase described it is that there needed to be zero transactions costs. Okay, and what we mean by transactions costs are costs of negotiations. Okay, the kind of things that makes this work, as long as there are small number of parties, and information costs are low, measurement costs are low. Okay. Then this can work. But if we have the problem of, say, large numbers, then this problem, then this solution will not produce the outcome we want. So let's suppose that there are 100 laundries. Each losing $1 due to the chemical factory. So, court finds in favor of the laundry service. So, in order for the chemical factory to continue to pollute, it must negotiate with each of the laundry services. So, C offers each laundry $5. So each laundromat's losing a dollar because of the chemical factory. The court finds in favor of the 100 laundries. And the court, so the laundry, the 100 laundries are entitled to clean air or clean water or whatever source, the way the emissions are hitting their business. And they have a chance now to be compensated by the chemical factory, and they've each been offered $5. So that means HL makes a $4 profit. Okay. So what will this cost the chemical factory? So total cost for C should be $500, right? Which is half the cost of the scrubber. Okay? Well, so C negotiates with the first 99 laundry and pays out $495. The 100th laundry sees an opportunity. Okay. So the chemical factory has got 99 of the 100 laundry services signed up. They've paid out $5 each or $495. But if they don't get all 100 laundries signed off, they have to buy a $1,000 scrubber. So this guy asks for $500. And says to the to C that $495 + $500 = $995 is less than the $1,000 scrubber. So even paying me $500, you're still better off than if you had to buy a scrubber. Okay, so this is what's referred to as the holdup problem. And this is what arises if you have large numbers and one firm, like one chemical factory and 100 laundry services, requires extensive negotiation. In the existence of the holdup problem, the chemical factory may never come to a deal, in which case we do not get the outcome where the chemical factory compensates everybody, the whole thing falls apart, and they have to buy a $1,000 scrubber. Okay? So, in this case, the court may give the right to C because they know that they won't be able to negotiate. So in a perfect world, if we find in favor of the laundromats, the courts will give the right to the laundromat, then the chemical factory compensates all the laundromats, spends $500, which is more efficient than spending $1,000, and the world's better off. But if the court thinks there's going to be something that prevents the bargaining between the two people, then the court will give the right to the chemical factory if the court thinks bargaining won't happen. Okay. So there are many other types of transactions costs that can get in the way of bargaining between the parties. And this sometimes leads to people to wonder about how the court system works. Well, the court system looks at the game tree and says that the most efficient outcome is that we do not spend $1,000 on a scrubber to fix a $100 problem. I know that if I give the right to the laundromat, the chemical factory would pay him to be allowed to pollute. If I give the right to the chemical factory, the laundromat will not pay enough to get the chemical factory to buy the scrubber and not pollute. So the outcome should be that the chemical factory pollutes. It's just a matter of compensation. So if the courts think this won't work, then they may rule in favor of the chemical factory, which often people look at and go, why would the courts find in that way? And the Coase theorem has greatly influenced how the court system works. Okay, so this has been known as the famous Coase theorem. Okay. And this has led to what we call decentralized policy. So what is going on is that the government is not getting directly involved in the emissions or regulating the emissions of the chemical factory. Instead, what they are doing is setting up a system where the parties that are affected will address the problem through the courts. So if somebody is polluting and the victim takes them to court, the court decides whether or not they're going to be protected or the other side has the right to pollute. There is no active government regulation telling the polluter how much emissions they're allowed to put out. The problem is being sorted out between individuals through the court system. Now, a variation from this is to deal with this problem of bargaining. So try to hold to the court, to the Coase theorem, but make sure that there is some form of compensation. There have been the introduction of what are called liability laws. And they are designed to create the outcome of Coase. Okay. So there are two types of liability. Okay. There is what's known as strict liability. And negligence. Okay, so with strict liability, no matter what you do, if an accident happens, you're at fault. So in the case of a pedestrian versus the automobile. So, if you drive a car, in this country, you're subject to strict liability laws, that the automobile driver will be held liable if he hits a pedestrian, no matter what the circumstances. So, the law has been written to put the onus on the part of the automobile driver to not drive over pedestrians. In part, this is there because people with automobiles can't afford and are required to have auto insurance. So if they're in the wrong, their insurance pays medical bills. Okay. Also, pedestrians, you may or may not know when you're driving whether or not the person who is walking along the side of the road is a fully grown adult who fully comprehends the situation, or if that person is a child, or that person is in some way mentally impaired, to not recognize the danger. So the courts have said, no matter what, the guy driving the car is in the wrong. And negligence, on the other hand, looks at what's referred to as a due care, which is a level of care. Okay. So if you can demonstrate that you have taken a certain level of care and an accident happens, then you're not considered liable and you don't have to pay damages. But if it can be demonstrated that you have not taken due care, then you are liable for all damages. Okay. So how does that work in the environmental world? So let's consider the case of our emissions, and we have our marginal savings, and we have our marginal damage function, so the court says, so liability says, firms can pollute, firms can pollute, but they pay any damage. Okay, so if the firm is polluting at the unregulated level where the marginal savings of emissions is zero, then their liability will be the damages that are incurred up to that point. So if they pollute, they have to pay compensation equal to the area under the marginal damage curve. So if they reduce their pollution, their emissions, to say E prime, then they're only liable for the damages that occur up to that point. So by reducing their emissions, they reduce their liability and they only pay that area. So what will happen is that the firm will reduce their emissions to the point where the marginal damage or the marginal liability equals the marginal savings. So a strict liability rule tells firms that they will wind up having to pay this amount in damages, and that will be their liability. So a strict liability rule should produce the efficient outcome. Okay. Now, the courts can also use a form of the negligence rule. And the negligence rule, in this case, would say that if your emissions are less than or equal to E bar, you don't pay damages. Right? But for any E greater than E bar, firms are liable. Okay? So, let's look at how that story would work. So firms, we have the emissions and we have the marginal damage function. And the government comes along and says that if your emissions are between zero and E bar, you're not liable, you do not have to pay damages. So the payment or liability for the firm is zero till it hits E bar. But for any emissions greater than E bar, then you are responsible. Oops. Then the firm is responsible for the area under the marginal damage curve. So if the firm stops at E bar, they pay no damages. But after that, they pay damages based on the area under the marginal damage curve. So if E bar is set correctly, such that E bar is where the marginal savings equals the marginal damage, then the firm doesn't pay. The firm will pollute to E bar, and the only cost the firm will have is the abatement cost. But they won't have to pay the damages. So the damages then still occur and go back onto society, but the firm doesn't have to pay, are not liable for the area under the marginal damage curve up to E bar. So this produces the same efficient outcome if E bar is set, if equals our socially efficient outcome, then we have the correct negligence rule. Okay.